afternoon, and welcome back to Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Gary Eichten. Glad you could join us. I think it's safe to say that Minnesota has not been a magnet for the presidential candidates. Michigan, South Carolina, New Hampshire, even Iowa for that matter, but not Minnesota. However, there is one exception. Reform Party presidential candidate Pat Buchanan is back in Minnesota again this week, trying to round up support for the March 7th precinct caucuses and perhaps head off a decision by state Reform Party leaders to follow Jesse Ventura's lead and cut their ties with the national party. Last night, about 250 supporters turned out for a Buchanan fundraiser in St. Cloud. This evening, he has a fundraiser in suburban Oakdale. This noon, he's come by our studios to talk about his campaign and to take your questions. Reform Party presidential candidate Pat Buchanan is our guest this hour. And if you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call here. Twin City area number is 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Outside the Twin Cities, 1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Pat Buchanan, thanks for joining us today.
Gary, thanks for inviting me over and giving me the hour. Appreciate it very much.
Well, now, here you are in Ventura country. Have you had any contact with the governor the last couple of days?
Well, no. I've been told by my staff not to get in contact with Governor Ventura again until I get my Secret Service protection. So, let me be serious. No, I have not. I had tried to get in contact with the governor in an earlier visit, and I did, I guess, back when I was a Republican. But we have not sought to have any contact with the governor since he's decided to disaffiliate the Minnesota Reform Party and make it the Minnesota Independence Party again. I regret the governor's decision. I respect it. And my guess is he's going to go about and accomplish that, and these caucuses will thus be pretty much moot by the 7th of Minnesota. I'm up here. Basically, we were here as part of a campaign commitments we had made because we were going to do battle for the delegates of the Reform Party to the National Convention in those caucuses, where I thought that the governor's idea of where the Reform Party should go and my idea, we could have a head-to-head debate and argument, and I thought it would be good for Minnesota, and I thought it would be good for the Reform Party, and we would find the relative strength of our positions here in Minnesota. But it's not to be, but I have to keep the commitments I made earlier to make a number of appearances up here in the next 2 days.
If the Reform Party, as we know it today, severs its ties with the National Party, are you going to make some attempt then, you and your supporters, to build a new Reform Party here in Minnesota?
Exactly. We anticipate that the governor will be successful on the 4th of March in disaffiliating from the National Reform Party, creating or recreating an independence party in Minnesota. And what we will do is we will begin to create a new Reform Party of Minnesota. We will take the opportunity to get it on the ballot nationally by getting sufficient number of signatures, 2,000, I believe, to get the Reform Party on the ballot and to get my name on the ballot as well for November. We will do that. I think there's the window to do that is in the summer, in July. We intend to accomplish that in a matter of a couple of weeks. We will send a delegation from Minnesota to the National Convention, pledged to Pat Buchanan for president, and we will be on the ballot as the Reform Party in the fall with Pat Buchanan, the nominee of the Minnesota Reform Party, and I guess that would end all connections with the Independence Party, which would be Governor Ventura's party.
Mm-hmm. Right now, clear sailing for you for the nomination. You're the only candidate, as far as I know.
Well, since the great statesman Donald Trump withdrew his name from consideration, it looks like it is clear sailing. There are some other candidates. I think the former candidate of the Natural Law Party is running. I know a couple of other individuals. I go to the conventions I go to and speak and am on forums with. There's about six or seven individuals running, but I guess I'm the most prominent right now.
What about Ross Perot? We keep hearing rumors that he's going to, when all is said and done, decide to run again.
My suspicion would be that Ross does not intend to run. Of course, he is very well respected in the party. He's the father of the third party in the 1990s. He ran a very gallant race in 1992, a very strong race. 19% was a tremendously strong race. I do not anticipate he will run, but if he does, he would be a formidable candidate and a very tough challenger for the Reform Party nomination. There's a lot of loyalty to him in this party. In any event, if he does not run, I certainly hope he would help us in the great battle that's coming up to deny permanent most favored nation trade status to communist China. Gary, just a day ago, the communist Chinese literally threatened to use force against Taiwan if it did not start talking seriously about rejoining, as they call it, communist China, even though Taiwan has never been ruled by communist China and has only been ruled from China for 4 years during this entire century. This is almost a replay of the Sudeten crisis, where Hitler demanded the return of the Sudeten Germans, who had been part of the Austrian Empire, and demanded them by a date certain, or he was going to use force. I think this is a real test of the West and the United States of America. Now, no one wants a war with China. No one wants a military conflict. But the people of Taiwan have a right not to have a communist tyranny imposed upon them by force. So what I would do here is, if I were the Republicans and the Democrats, I would stand up to Mr. Clinton and to the Chinese and say, we reject the idea of giving you permanent, wide-open access to America's markets and the $70 billion in trade surpluses you get from that every year, unless and until we get guarantees that you will not invade or attack the people of Taiwan.
If they do attack, what should we do?
I don't think the United States could stand aside and let the agreements we have had with Communist China, the Shanghai Communique — I was in Shanghai when that was signed with Richard Nixon in 1972. I'm one of 10 surviving members of that delegation. We cannot permit the Chinese to launch rockets indiscriminately and with impunity against our friends on Taiwan, or blockade their ports, or attack their air bases, or really close that island down. I think we would have to tell the Chinese first and foremost that they would have made themselves an antagonist to this country. We would cut off all Chinese sales to the United States, embargo all their goods. I think we would affect the removal from many of these institutions to which they now belong. And in the last analysis, I think we would have to help the Chinese, certainly with weapons, to repel any kind of attack.
Troops?
No. No, American ground troops, I do not believe, should fight another ground war or land war in Asia. We've done that three times in this century, against Japan, in South Korea, and in Vietnam. I don't believe the American people would support the drafting and conscripting of a large army of 500,000 or 1 million men to send them to fight. I believe in the old Nixon doctrine, whereby the Asian countries provide the troops for their own defense, and we become again what we were in the early years of World War II, the great arsenal of democracy that provides the defensive weapons and the wherewithal these nations need to defend their own countries. Churchill said, "Give us the tools, and we will finish the job." And I think that should be the role of the United States.
Presidential candidate Pat Buchanan is our guest this hour, and again, let me give you the number here. All of our phone lines are busy, so don't call right now. You'll just get frustrated, but jot the number down. Try us in a few minutes as we work our way through the phone bank. 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Outside the Twin Cities, you can reach us toll-free at 1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Let's see. First call is from Rochester. Dale?
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. Mr. Buchanan, I appreciate the opportunity to ask you a question.
Well, thank you, Dale.
As I understand your I haven't followed your political career real closely, but obviously I've heard you on Talk of the Nation and a few other places. As I understand your attitude towards America's involvement in the world, you think we should not have military presence here and there and be doing everything for everybody. Certainly you get a lot of credibility because of the current administration's pretty poor record. But the one exception that I've noticed is Israel. I believe I've heard you say that we should have a presence there, and if necessary, a military presence.
Mm-hmm.
And
let me correct you on that.
Okay.
The pejorative term is they called me a cold warrior from the time I went into journalism and politics and government and the White House, where I served 8 years. I did believe that the Soviet Empire represented a mortal threat to the liberties and the security and the things in which we Americans believe. And I supported all the efforts of the Cold War presidents, especially the three under whom I served, to roll back the Soviet Empire, as Reagan successfully did. But once the Cold War is over, it is my view, and the Soviet Empire's collapsed, and the Soviet Union's collapsed, and broken up into 15 independent countries, some of them independent, like the Baltic Republics, and democratic, I believe the United States should have withdrawn its ground forces from Europe as the Red Army withdrew from Central and Eastern Europe. With regard to the Middle East, I do not favor, indeed I strongly oppose, the idea of General Scowcroft, who I believe is an advisor to Governor Bush, to put a division of American troops up on the Golan Heights in the event of an agreement between Syria and Israel. I think that would be a dreadful mistake for the United States. I think there would be a high probability of some sort of terrorists committing atrocities against the Americans, a huge explosion in the United States. And if there are going to be any troops on the Golan Heights, I think they really, or NATO troops of any kind, I really believe they ought to be French troops or some other units, because whenever you put Americans on the ground anywhere, there's a tremendous premium on killing one or two or three, as the terrorists did in Lebanon when they hung that colonel who was an American with the UN forces. So I am against any American military presence in the Israeli quarrel with Syria, the Palestinians, and Egypt. I would even affect, I think, a fairly early removal of the Americans from the Sinai Peninsula, where we've got a number of troops on Mount Sinai, as a matter of fact, who are observers. I don't know that they're needed there anymore.
Is there any circumstance, short of a direct attack on the United States, where you would favor U.S. military involvement?
There are many circumstances where I would favor military support by the United States on behalf of friends and allies. It would be another issue of whether or not the United States should muster a gigantic army like World War II, or an army the size of the one we sent to Vietnam and Korea. It's hard for me, Gary, to see right now anywhere in the world where I would favor doing that again. Certainly, the United States ought to use its military forces to defend its strategic, its vital interest. And by that, I certainly mean the security of our own country, our own continent, the oceans around the United States of America. I believe we have allies and friends in Europe and Asia, but as I indicated, in those areas, I would primarily rely on local troops. Those nations have plenty of soldiers they can provide, and the United States can provide them with the military wherewithal to defend their own independence and integrity. The idea of having Americans as the Hessians of the New World Order, I find a repulsive one.
What about those standing up for basic moral principles? You know, as we look around the world and you see some horrible humanitarian crisis develop, don't we have some kind of obligation to do something?
Well, there's no question about it. As the greatest country on earth and the great republic, the United States has got to stand up for what its beliefs and values are, even from those presidents who are derided as so-called isolationists, which amounts to our first 20 presidents. They believe we ought to hold up the banner of freedom, but they did not believe, for example, that the United States should go off to Europe and help fight for the independence of Greece when Lord Byron was there. There was a great conflict in this country. When the Hungarians rose up against the Austrian Empire in 1848, Kossuth came to the United States and got tremendous receptions here. He wanted the Americans to step in against the Russians when the Russians were sort of helping the Austrians put down the rebellion. And Henry Clay, who was on his deathbed, said, you know, we believe deeply in your cause, but our role is to keep the lamp of freedom burning on the western shore and not to intervene in the internal affairs of Europe. And I think when we did in 1917, Wilson tried to stay out as long as he did. I think it was a dreadful mistake. I think it's one of the reasons why we had the dismemberment of Germany and after World War II at Versailles and that disastrous treaty, which I think did lead to, certainly led to Hitler, Mussolini, and eventually Stalin and Lenin, so that the war to make the world safe for democracy made it safe for some of the greatest enemies democracy had ever seen. Let's take the case you just described, or we heard described. It said we've got a first world war in Africa. yeah, that might be an exaggeration, but clearly what's going on in the Congo, they got troops from various countries in there, guerrillas. Angola, I believe, is helping out on one side or the other. There's Burundi, Rwanda, Uganda, Congo, Congo Brazzaville. Zimbabwe's got troops involved. Nelson Mandela's trying to bring it to a close. Do I think we should send soldiers in there? No, I do not. Do I think we ought to use our good offices to bring it to an end? Yes, I do.
Emery, your question, please.
Yes, my question for Mr. Buchanan, a pleasure speaking with you, is that it seems every administration for some time now has been directly influenced in one way or the other, the foreign policy and other aspects of the government, by groups such as the Trilateral Commission.
Whoops. Emery, your phone cut out on us.
I think I know where he's going. There is a sense that the two national parties and their foreign policy are dominated by members of the Council on Foreign Relations and the Trilateral Commission, and basically a group of foreign policy professionals and experts in law, academia, politics, and government, that one group moves out of government when the other election is won, and they go into the foundations and think tanks, and then they basically share power back and forth. I agree with the criticism exactly. I think we need a whole new foreign policy elite of those who believe, as I do, that it is time for the United States, now that our great wars are over, to begin to look out for America and Americans first, to stay out of wars that are none of our business, in the tradition of Washington and Quincy Adams and Ronald Reagan, and to develop trade policies and foreign policies that first and foremost look out for the United States of America. Gary, let me give you an example. Mr. Clinton prides himself on the fact that he bailed out Mexico with $50 billion. Mr. Bush's favorite, his great achievement was what? Rescuing Kuwait and Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states from Iraq. What are Mexico, Kuwait, the Gulf states, and Saudi Arabia doing now? They're engaged in a criminal conspiracy called OPEC to raise oil prices from $10 to $30 a barrel, to gouge the American consumers and the American people whose money rescued Mexico and whose sons went over there to the Middle East and the Gulf to save Kuwait, the Gulf states, and Saudi Arabia. Now, these countries, Mexico and Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, I understand what they're doing. They're very coldly looking out for their national interest. If they can gouge the United States for more money, and the $20 run-up in the price of oil is going to cost us $75 billion out of here this year, if they can do that, they do it. I don't understand why no one in Washington's looking out for the United States or the American people. Why we take it? Now, I don't mean we don't be belligerent toward Mexico or Saudi Arabia or Kuwait, but you sit down and you represent your people, your nation. And if we don't do that, who do we think will?
Of course, a lot of countries around the world would argue, well, that's all we're interested in is our own interests, that we don't have any, that we are trying to impose our values, our power on them.
There is some legitimate criticism of the United States of America if you take what we did in Kosovo. Now, that was a bloody civil war inside a province of Yugoslavia, Serbia, which had belonged to Serbia for generations. There were atrocities, the majority of them perpetrated by the Serbs, who were in control. They were ignited by Albanians who would shoot three or four police officers in the back, and then the Serbs would perpetrate an atrocity which would involve innocent civilians. And then the Albanians would get enraged, and they would shoot some more soldiers or police, and back and forth. Now, the United States should have used its good offices to try to bring that to a close. Instead, we bombed Serbia for 78 days. We're now denying oil to that country, freezing people and denying light and heat to people who never did anything to our country. I do agree we're behaving like an imperial power. That's why I wrote my book, which is entitled A Republic, Not an Empire. Why are we behaving like an empire? Now, and there are some areas where the United States' influence abroad, what we call our soft power, there's not much we can do about it. Young people all over the world love American rock music and jeans and McDonald's. And many other countries, Canadians included, see this as really sort of a cultural invasion and cultural oppression I can understand their resentment, and I respect what they're doing to say preserve their culture, but there's not much we can do about something like that. But what we can do is not try to dictate, in other words, we believe in free markets here, and much more open markets than the Europeans do, who call ours savage capitalism. We believe in democracy, and we believe in a democratic republic. I don't think we ought to try to impose our system on every other country. I think when countries go astray from that course, we should not break relations with them and denounce them and have the State Department get up and say that, you know, they're falling, they're backsliding on the road to the future. I think we ought to deal with other countries with respect and dignity. And as Jack Kennedy said, we have an embrace for the Democrats, and if necessary, we have a handshake for the dictators.
Mario, your question, please.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Buchanan, I was interested to read in your autobiography, right from the beginning, that you view the following three men as your heroes. Mm-hmm. General Franco of Spain, mm-hmm. U.S. Senator Joseph McCarthy, and General MacArthur. Now, these are people who are not near and dear to my heart, or I believe to that of many other working people around the world. And I was wondering if you could explain your thinking.
Sure. You've misread my book. I did not say that they were my heroes. I said they were my father's heroes, my late father, who came to maturity in the 1920s and the 1930s. I would say General MacArthur was his hero. He was a defender of General Franco's, and he was an admirer, as half the American people were by 1954, of Joe McCarthy, because he thought what McCarthy was doing, despite the mistakes he had made, was fundamentally correct. But they were my father's heroes, not mine. Just as, frankly, they were the heroes of Teddy Kennedy's father.
Mm-hmm. Not to bog down on this, but in retrospect, your own opinion on the three?
Well, in retrospect, I think Douglas MacArthur was probably the greatest general the United States produced in strategic thinking since Robert E. Lee. I think he was a tremendous, tremendous general. He had fewer casualties than any other general virtually in World War II. He did not waste his men by throwing them up on beaches. He bypassed Japanese strong points. His invasion of Incheon was a strategic masterstroke. General Franco is to be preferred over the communists and Leninists who would have prevailed, I think, in Spain. As for Senator McCarthy, I would urge folks, there's a new book out by Arthur Herman. It is a biography of Joe McCarthy, which I think it is getting tremendous, it's getting reviews. It's a subject of enormous controversy. There was a very long review in the New Republic, and it argues that McCarthy made some dreadful mistakes and errors and blunders. He was a man of great flaws, but in his overall view, that the government of the United States was shot through with treason and with communists, he was fundamentally right. Let me give you, Gary, one fact. Henry Wallace was Mr. Roosevelt's vice president in his third term. If FDR had fallen over and died in 1944 rather than 1945, Wallace would have been president. His likely Secretary of State, Lawrence Duggan, his Undersecretary of State, Alger Hiss, and his Secretary of the Treasury, Harry Dexter White, would not only have been communists, they would have been Stalinist spies. Now, that's astonishing, the degree of penetration in the government of the United States. And this book by Dr. Arthur Herman, the new book, it's gotten some critical reviews, is one really I read over Christmas, and I wrote him a letter on that. I really think it ought to be read because it puts things in a much better perspective, and it often takes a lot of time before you've got a full understanding of what history is.
Reform Party presidential candidate Pat Buchanan is our guest this hour, and we'll get to some more callers here in just a couple of minutes. Right now, let's catch up on some news headlines. Here's Greta Cunningham. Greta?
Thanks, Gary. Good afternoon. President Clinton says America has a once-in-a-generation opportunity to help open up China. He's also warning that congressional rejection of his China trade deal would be a devastating setback for the U.S. economy. The president used a speech to leading CEOs in Washington to urge that Congress approve permanent trade ties to China. Such ties are part of a deal that would let Beijing join the World Trade Organization. Clinton acknowledges that he faces an uphill battle with lawmakers. Administration officials are seeking an early vote, fearing the issue will get bogged down in election year politics. The United Nations Security Council voted today to send an observer force into the Congo to monitor a fragile ceasefire. The force would also lay the groundwork for a possible full-fledged UN peacekeeping operation. The Energy Department says low stocks of oil and gasoline will probably send gas prices even higher this spring. An energy official told a Senate panel this morning that low inventories of crude oil and heating and diesel fuel led to the sharp and sudden price increases of recent weeks. Average heating oil costs in the Northeast jumped 66%. In regional news, the Minnesota Senate has overwhelmingly rejected Steve Mintz's confirmation as head of the merged departments of Commerce and Public Service. Senate Majority Leader Roger Moe personally urged Mintz's rejection. Governor Ventura says the Senate's action will make it harder to recruit other commissioners from the private sector. He says the Senate vote is pure politics. Business organizations in the Twin Cities are forming a task force to look into how much value the area gets from being a hub for Northwest Airlines. Former Governor Arnie Carlson and Minneapolis businessman Vance Opperman will co-chair the task force. The forecast for the state of Minnesota today calls for cloudy skies statewide with high temperatures near 45 in the north to 55 in the south. Still a report of fog throughout the region. Rochester reports fog in 44. There's fog in St. Cloud in 37 degrees. Duluth reports foggy skies in 36. And in the Twin Cities, a report of fog, a temperature of 43. Gary, that's a check on the latest news.
Thanks, Greta. 27 minutes before 1. This is Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. And our guest this hour, Reform Party presidential candidate Pat Buchanan. If you have a question for Mr. Buchanan, number to call is 651-227-6000. That's Twin City area number, 651-227-6000. Outside the Twin Cities, 1-800-242-2828. Big budget surplus building up in Washington. What should the politicians do with that money? Send it back in the form of a tax cut? Put it aside to try to preserve Social Security? Spend it on needed social programs? What would you do with the money?
Gary, in the next 10 years, they estimate, I think the federal government will probably collect something in the neighborhood of $25 to $30 trillion. $4 trillion of that is unbudgeted, half of it for Social Security, half of it Social Security revenue, and the other half is the income tax revenues. I would do what I think is the right thing, which is not collect it. If you go to buy a VCR, however much that costs, let's say a couple hundred dollars, and you give them $500 and it only costs $375, fella usually gives you your change back. Federal government wants to say, well, Gary, we'd like to hold on to this money and use it for some good purpose. In my view, the Social Security surplus should be used for exactly that, Social Security. Take it all and set it aside in accounts for each future recipient of Social Security, an account with their name on it. The income tax surplus, since it hasn't been collected, don't collect it. Collect the money we need to balance the budget. Leave that money with the American people, since it's their money, they earned it, and the government doesn't need it.
Mm-hmm. Privatize Social Security. There's a lot of talk about that, or at least part of the Social Security accounts, so that people could conceivably earn more.
I would not use the term privatize. The government of the United States has a commitment that's been made to working Americans, and they've been taking out money to fulfill that commitment. And the government should say, regardless of what you do, we are going to fulfill that commitment. You're going to get a set amount that we promised you, and we're not going to interfere with that promise. Now, the idea of putting some of the money into accounts with the Social Security recipient's name on it is a way to ensure that the politicians don't do what they did in the last 15 years, which is take the Social Security surplus, spend it on what they wanted, and leave an IOU sitting in the Social Security account. So put it in the names of the Social Security recipients. I wouldn't call that privatized. in the sense that I think the World Bank, for example, ought to be privatized, that the United States should get out of guaranteeing loans to foreign countries and let the World Bank make the money from those loans if they work and take the losses if they lose it.
Jim, your question, please.
Hi, it's a pleasure to talk to you, Mr. Buchanan.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people in this country realize that you perhaps may represent, if you are the Reform Party candidate, the best opportunity. I think the basic, most serious issue would get raised. I don't think it's necessarily going to be raised by the Democratic-Republican candidates. Alan Greenspan said yesterday that this has been a decade of unprecedented prosperity. But I think you have some awareness of the fact that underneath all this prosperity, a constitution continues to erode. My particular concern has been focused on education.
Mm-hmm.
And both the Republican and Democratic parties, starting with George Bush with America 2000 and now Clinton with Goals 2000, is going along with the globalization process in that power is both on the global and national level continuing to centralize in total ignorance or contradiction to the Constitution, carefully balancing power. And I just wondered, it seems like almost no one is able to get across the idea to the American people how it says in the, it does not say in the Constitution that education is a federal role, and yet the federal government is running education more and more. How will you be able to explain to the American people that education, along with a number of other things in our country, are being centralized further and further and taking away the power of self-government from the American people?
Well, the Constitution should be our watchword, and you are exactly right. The federal government in the area of education has massively usurped the authority of the states and local communities and of parents. And the federal government, which only spends 6 or 7% of the tax dollars for primary and secondary education, gives out something like 50% of the rules and regulations. And whether it's School to Work or Goals 2000 or Profiles in Living or these other programs, the federal government is increasingly trying to force primary and secondary education into a mold whereby children are no longer educated in the liberal tradition, in the history of their country, in geography, and spelling, and literature, and English, but they are in knowledge, but they are trained for the labor force of the future according to the commands of major corporations. And this, as you know, is going on in Minnesota. At the federal level, what you can do is two things. You can take the entire budget of primary and secondary education at the federal level, turn it into block grants unrestricted, send it back to the state of Minnesota so that the folks in Minnesota can decide how their children want to be educated, and secondly, use that bully pulpit of the presidency to argue for a traditional education where we Americans train citizens who can think, who understand the origins and history of their country and of their culture, and who can really are independent, active agents and beings. And rather than training them for using them as a means to an ends of ever higher production.
Didn't the Goals 2000 program and the rest of it, didn't that grow out of the fact, though, that too many children were getting out of school and they didn't know anything?
Mm-hmm.
And that some kind of an attempt to set some standards was called for. Wasn't that the whole emphasis there?
Well, it was begun, there's no doubt about it. I think it was begun in the Lamar Alexander administration of the Department of Education. Lamar is a friend of mine, and I believe it was in Mr. Bush's administration. But, Gary, I don't think they're coming out any more knowledgeable in the year 2000 than they did in 1990. I think by scholastic aptitude tests, which are even though they've been dumbing down those tests, even some of the scores have really not risen. We're nowhere near where we were in 1964. And why is that? After we've spent literally hundreds of billions of dollars on education, why are the products being produced not as high qualified in terms of their knowledge or in terms of what's going on in the schools? The schools are, I mean, there are places where now, in many cases, where learning doesn't even take place. So I think the intrusion of federal bureaucrats, of federal judges in education, of the education industry, of the NEA, and the tremendous growth in power of the teachers' unions, they have gone hand in hand with a decline in education. So in order to reform education truly, we've got to find out who ruined education in America. We got to find out who's responsible for the fact that the American children, in terms of what they know and understand about themselves and the world and history, coming out of their high schools and math and science, are below every other Western country. Why, when we're spending more per pupil than any other country in the world virtually, are we doing so badly? Who's been in charge? In the last 8 years, it's been Clinton and Gore. Now, maybe some of these problems go right back to Mr. Bush and Lamar Alexander, my old friend. But clearly, the Bush-Gore administration has been a disaster for public education.
David, your question, please.
Yes. Mr. Buchanan, pleasure to speak with you.
Right.
I followed your career for several years, and I like a lot of what I've heard you say, and some of what I don't particularly agree with. Just a general statement. I think as far as this oil crisis is going, mm-hmm. Americans and policymakers seem to have this belief that we are just automatically entitled to that oil. Mm-hmm. And the price of gas is $1.50 a gallon, but there's going to be a time very shortly when the gas is not going to be there anymore. And, you know, I don't hear anything from many of the politicians speaking about we need to take some of this projected surplus and put it back into developing cleaner burning technologies and better, more renewable fuels and start planning now for what's inevitable rather than complaining because we're being charged too much.
Well, let me disagree with you in part. Even though consumption of, in many cases, even with these SUVs on the roads now, our American vehicles are far, far more fuel efficient than they were when I was growing up and far more fuel efficient than they were in the 1970s. In addition, new drilling techniques have dramatically increased the potential supply of oil in the world. We've been discovering Caspian Sea oil. They do side drilling. The deep water drilling is now not just 1,000 feet, but 7,000 feet. So the supply has increased, and frankly, the increase in the price of oil will increase the supply because people will go, it's efficient and cost effective to go out and look for it. I do agree with you 100%, though, that the United States should have an energy policy which looks toward energy independence, far greater energy independence than we have today. And I think that there are some steps we can take, and we can use against OPEC the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, I believe, and we can pump it out and try to crack their prices. I think we can use a low-level oil import fee so that the Saudis and the others don't do what they did a year ago, which was drive down the price to $10 a barrel, where in Texas, for example, you can't pump for $10 a barrel and make money, so they close down all those wells, and then the Saudis and the others jack the price up, but the Texas wells are closed. So we got to have a strategy for that. My guess is you might not like this. I think we ought to take another look at nuclear power. We ought to take another look at opening up the ANWR to prospective drilling. We ought to take another look at multiplying the number of oil pipelines coming out of the Caspian area and the Transcaucasus area, rather than relying on this new project of Mr. Clinton and the Strobe Talbot. There are a lot of things we can do, but frankly, we've got to use our leverage over the oil-producing states as well. I would say no IMF loans, no World Bank loans to any country that joins OPEC and attempts to gouge the American consumer.
Next caller is from Minneapolis. Bernard?
This question concerns, well, actually, there are two. First of all, I should like to ask Mr. Buchanan if he has read Gaviota's A Village to Reinvent the World.
No.
Concerning Gaviota's Columbia.
I have not read that, sir.
Okay, second question.
Right.
That book shows the miracles that can be done with intelligent utilization of solar power.
Okay, and your second question then?
And the second question is whether or not he is considering a rational approach to the war on drugs, in short, legalizing them so that mm-hmm. there is not a market for the drugs which flow out of Latin America through Mexico into this country.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've argued that on solar power, I think that the very fact that oil becomes very expensive and other forms of energy become expensive makes solar power much more attractive. But I think that fundamentally you're going to have to, the free market is going to have to bring solar power on stream. I was back in the, I forget whether it was Nixon or Reagan, when they were into oil shale, and we dumped enormous amounts of money into these energy corporations, and it was a total waste of money. They never became effective, and it was, we had a devil's time of it shutting them down, because even some of our good conservatives got addicted to the federal subsidies. Now, on the drug war, this is a very, very tough issue. I understand that, but I have seen gone in this campaign, for example, I went down to Iowa, and I went to this place where women who had been addicted to drugs during their pregnancy were in a home with their tots and their toddlers and babies, and they were going in the workforce, and they were free of drugs. And I saw these little children there, and this is in the heart of Iowa, and I asked the folks there, were the kids affected by the fact their mothers were addicted to drugs when they were born? And they said 10% of the children born in Iowa, their mothers have a drug affliction. And with 5% of the babies born in Iowa, the affliction is permanent. In other words, damage is done to the mind or something of these children. And these were tots, and they were beautiful little kids. And to think that 5% of them, their life is going to be crippled in some way because of addiction to drugs, has made me really even more resolute against the idea of legalizing narcotics. I am afraid that could be virtually the end of this society. I'm just against it. I understand the argument for it. I understand that if you take away the financial incentive, there's no incentive to grow the cocoa. There's no incentive for the cartel in Colombia or the cartels that have moved into Mexico after NAFTA. But the price up here, I don't think the American people want to pay it. I think they want to fight.
Jack, you're next. Your question, please.
Yes, Pat, I wish you would explain your position on immigration. I just want to say that Minnesota has been a very gracious host to many, many immigrants.
Right.
My own personal experience has been that after 5 years of tutoring refugees and immigrants from Cambodia, Hmong people, Vietnamese, and Latin Americans, that they're most appreciative and deserving and respond very, very well to the open door that they've received here in Minnesota.
Well, most immigrants certainly do. There's no doubt about it. My view is that on legal immigration, now that we have brought in 30 million people in the last 30 years, we do need a period of assimilation, such as we've had before in our history after high periods of immigration. So on legal immigration, I would simply cut it back to 300,000 a year, and I would rearrange it so that many who have waited in line in various countries can get in. Today, because of the policy they have whereby family members, and not just a husband brings a wife and his two say children under 18, but his mother and his brothers and others, via chain immigration, almost all of our immigration comes from 6 or 8 countries, 10 at most, from 130 or 180 countries around the world. So I would rearrange where they came from, and people waiting in line longest who wanted to be Americans, I would put at the top of the line. But I'll tell you this, I was down on that border at Douglas, Arizona, and what is happening down there with immigrants, the women being just their, how they're mistreated when they're brought across the line, and what is happening with thousands coming in illegal every night, and they're headed for our cities, and among the prison population, federal prison population, it's up to 25%, and the high prevalence of folks who are immigrants now from various countries and things who are on welfare, it didn't used to be the case, indicates we do need welfare reform and stop illegal immigration cold, which I would do, even if I had to put the military on the border of the United States. Mexico has a very strong policy about keeping folks out of Mexico, and we have a right to have an equally tough policy to defend our borders, even though legal immigration in the United States will remain the most generous country on earth.
So cut back on legal immigrants.
Halt the illegal cold, and people who have broken in and broken the law should be sent back.
Maury, your question, please.
Thank you. First of all, I want to tell you that I have Parkinson's disease, which affects the clarity of my speech.
Sounds good so far, Maury. Go ahead.
In fact, I used to be on this station back in the early 70s on National Public Radio.
Oh, yeah, okay.
There are some tapes of Nixon that have become available in the last year.
Mm-hmm.
And on those tapes, he turns out to be an out-of-the-closet anti-Semite. I mean, really making very strong statements about the Jews. And I know in defending various Nazi war criminals before Dumyanik, you left yourself open to the same charges. A lot of people think that true of you.
Okay, let's get a comment here.
Well, no, I have never defended anyone whom I knowingly believed to be a Nazi war criminal. The only individuals I have defended have been charged with that, and I believe they were innocent. Four of the six I defended were proven to be innocent. Frank Wallace and Ivan Stavelski of Denver, who were accused by the famous Nazi hunter Simon Wiesenthal in Austria, were proven innocent. John Dimyanik was a 10-year case where the Israeli Supreme Court, even after Dimyanik had been sentenced to death, agreed with me 100% that this was not Ivan the Terrible of Treblinka. And that was the best journalism I ever did. I believe I helped save a human being from being hanged in Jerusalem. There were two individuals who were sent back, one to Germany and the other to the Soviet Union, where he died within weeks, who I thought should have been tried in the United States with American justice. And they were not. I still argue they should have gotten trials here in this country. With regard to Mr. Nixon's statements, I have not seen them. I've heard of them. He did not use that language in my presence. If it does show that he had a bias or this sort of back, locker room anti-Semitism, that's discreditable and regrettable and wrong. But I would remind you that Golda Meir said that Israel never had a better friend than Richard Nixon. I was in the White House with Richard Nixon at Key Biscayne when we got word that the Israelis had been attacked in the Yom Kippur War, and we made the decision there to come back to Washington, and Richard Nixon flew everything in the American arsenal over there to save the Israeli government and nation when the Egyptians had crossed the canal in a surprise attack. And the Israeli leaders, Yitzhak Rabin, I used to be in Nixon's office when he was out of office, would call him on the phone, ask his counsel and advice. So I think we put all these things together. And I think you would not come to the conclusion that someone who had done that was what you would call a true anti-Semite. Now, let me take Lyndon Johnson. He used to use the N-word constantly in the White House. He used it all the time. So did Harry Truman. However, Harry Truman desegregated the armed forces. Lyndon Johnson was the primary mover in the Civil Rights Act of 1964. So let's take all those things on Johnson and Nixon and Truman and put them all together and then make a judgment on the whole man. But if you judge Mr. Nixon by a couple of tapes, you might say he's a dreadful creature. If you judge him by the whole life and the whole man, even with regard to Israel, I think you might come to a different conclusion.
Had a lot of time left, but let's get one more caller on here anyway. Mm-hmm. Bill, quick question, please.
Yeah, my question has to do with individual freedoms. In terms of the legal system, have we gone too far in terms of litigation? If someone like Ralph Nader argues that we need to keep our litigation open and free like it is to keep our individual rights against corporations. And secondarily, with all the consolidations in corporations, are they getting too strong? Where, as an individual American, should I be wary about all this, these issues?
I think that I agree with Ralph Nader with regard to the size of the multinational corporations and their power and their distance from people. Although I've always believed that governments are more dangerous than people who are in the business of making money. But I do agree with him about the transnationals. I think less and less do they have the interest of any country, including the United States, at heart. I think we've become too litigious society. There's too much lawsuits. There's not enough of us you know, solving our problems with each other. Every time something happens, it's in court. Or, I mean, many of these, for example, these sexual harassment things where women are harassed. It used to be that the woman's brother would come down and punch the guy in the nose and settle it right there instead of having to go all the way through the Supreme Court. So I think we've become too litigious a society and too much dependent on laws and judges to settle squabbles and issues that should be settled by ourselves.
You used to, when you were on TV as a TV commentator, you were always pretty entertaining. Would you take off your presidential candidate hat for just a moment, put on your commentator hat?
Sure. My McLaughlin group number?
What do you make of this business with the Reform Party, all the inter-party squabbling?
Well, if I had Pat Buchanan and Jesse Ventura and Ross Perot and Donald Trump in one party and I were a cartoonist, I would say God is smiling on me. There's no doubt about it. There's a great battle in this party for its heart and soul. It has been very entertaining, no doubt about it. There was a measure of chaos down there in Nashville. But I will say this, Gary, these are serious people in the Reform Party. They do believe in politics, issues, and ideas. They do care about things like that. They're not in it for, you know, being invited to the White House to some gathering with the president. And so I think what you're going to find is this Reform Party taking shape and form and identity. And by the time we come out of our convention in August, all this is Nashville is going to be forgotten. Buchanan versus Ventura is going to be forgotten. I think we're going to have a three-way race. It's definitely going to be Gore. It's definitely going to be Buchanan. I think it'll be Bush. And I think we're going to have a great campaign, and I think we're going to have the greatest turnout since the 1960 election when you got 60% turnout, although then they didn't let kids vote.
Are you... Do you really think you could win?
I think in a three-way contest, if I can get in those debates, yes.
Can you get in the debates?
That's the question. We're going to make an awful lot of noise on that one, and I think we are going to get into them, because I do believe that even the national press, many of whom, because they're very liberal, do not admire my views, have a sense that, look, we've got three parties recognized by the federal government. Three get money for their convention. Three get money for their campaigns. What are two of them doing conspiring to keep the third out of the debates, which are going to decide the election? The sense of injustice there, of conflict of interest, of denial of true democracy is so great that unless you're really almost blind to it, people are going to pick up on it.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll be in those debates. I won't be invited, but we'll come crashing right through that door.
On national TV?
On national TV, boom.
Or have an incident?
Maybe we'll get Mr. Ventura to hit the door ahead of me.
So we can look forward...
Do it on behalf of democracy.
So we can look forward to a kind of rapprochement between the governor...
Oh, I don't know about that. The governor and I disagree on a lot of things from what I've heard him say, and I regret he left the party, but we're going forward.
Well, thanks so much for coming in today, and good luck to you.
I've enjoyed it very much. Thanks for giving me the time.
Good talking to you.